Okay, let's get started because we've got plenty of material to cover. I'm Roger Dingeldine. You just heard from George about high latency email-based anonymity systems. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about lower latency anonymity systems. How many people here have heard of the Freedom Network or Tor or something like that? Oh, good. Okay, so I'm going to give you a basic overview of why you might care about this stuff. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what you might want to get out of it, how various approaches have been developed to provide it, a little bit more about onion routing, the details that Tor provides over previous onion routing, and then hidden services, recipient anonymity, and so on. Feel free to interrupt me whenever I say something that doesn't make sense or you've got questions or comments. And hopefully we'll be able to get through everything. So the basic idea here is, when you're using the internet, your packets are going from you, Alice, to the recipient, Bob, and they're tagged with where they're coming from and where they're going to, and anybody can look at these IP headers and know what's going on. And people think that they get complete security by encrypting their transactions, but that's not true. Encryption does not hide the routing information, so we're trying to provide something to protect the routing information of communications as well. And there are plenty of different reasons why you might want to use this. The typical examples we hear are political dissidents, whistleblowers, testing. That may be it for the mic.
Battery.
Testing. Oh, okay. Censorship-resistant publishers, speaking of which. And then we've got socially sensitive communicants. If you have cancer or AIDS or something like that, you want to be able to look at online forums about that without having your employer notice that you're looking at it and decide that you're going to start costing more and more money over time and he should fire you now. And then there's law enforcement who actually want this sort of thing for anonymous tips, crime reporting. A little bit after September 11th, the anonymizer set up a tip line for the FBI anonymously, and quite a few people, I'm told, used it. So the law enforcement side are really interested in having this technology out there as well. And corporations care about this. When I'm talking to researchers, I say I work on anonymity systems. When I'm talking to my parents, I work on privacy systems. When I'm talking to corporations, I provide security systems. And to the government, I provide traffic analysis resistant communication networks. It's all the same system, but each of them looks at it from a different perspective and needs different qualities from the software that they're using. From the corporation's perspective, they've got communications they're doing. They're looking at competitors' websites. They're talking to people that they might want to buy or sell to. And that's business intelligence. That's stuff that they need to protect. And encrypting it does not protect it. And you guys should care about this. What websites are you going to? What books are you buying? What kind of physicians do you look at online to figure out what you need? What medicines and so on? All of this stuff is being tracked and stuck in databases. You might want to consider trying to keep your data out of those databases because they're growing larger and larger and more people are finding interesting uses for them. So part of the goal here is to provide normal people the ability to protect themselves against the ever-growing tendency to data mine everything that happens. And government needs this stuff too. They want to do open source intelligence gathering, which is the same thing as competitive analysis, which is the same thing as private web browsing. They just call it different things. They would want to use it on their classified networks because their classified networks are really crunchy on the outside and they've got over a million secure users, except you can't possibly trust a million people to do anything securely. So they might want something on the inside also. And a lot of people say, well, gosh, I want to use this crypto-anarchist system, but not if the government's going to use it. And the government thinks, well, gosh, I need my traffic analysis resistant communication network, but not if these weird geeks are going to use it. But you gotta have both of them. You can't be anonymous by yourself. Encryption, it works. If Alice and Bob sit down and they say, I want to send encrypted mail, Alice encrypts it, Bob gets it and decrypts it, they're done. If Alice and Bob sit down and say, we want to anonymously communicate with each other, they can't do it by themselves. They need a network. They need something, more people to mix with, to blend with, so that they can get the security properties they're looking for. So the trick here is the Navy can't just provide an anonymous system and then have all of you guys show up and use it and provide cover traffic for them, because you won't do that. You don't trust them. Similarly, they can't have some hacker group running the whole thing, because then they won't trust that hacker group. So this brings on the notion of distributed trust. You want to have everybody who has a stake in things running a piece of the infrastructure, and you want to design the system so that you're robust against any small number of those pieces of the infrastructure colluding and trying to figure out who's communicating to who. And I'll tell you a little bit more about how that works in a bit. But the basic idea here is the security depends on the diversity of the network and how dispersed all of the nodes are in the network. And yes, criminals need anonymity too, but they already have it. Criminals are doing just fine if they're interested in breaking the, if they're willing to break the law, they're doing just fine stealing cell phones, using them, throwing in a ditch. They're doing just fine breaking into computers in China and Korea and so on and doing their transactions from there. Bad people already have anonymity. It's the good people who don't have it. We're trying to provide something so that honest citizens who want to follow the law can have some security. Okay, so there are a lot of different types of anonymity you might want. Imagine you're trying to protect yourself against the recipient of your message or the website you're going to. Or maybe the website wants to protect itself against the people who are going to it. Maybe if you can find out the address of the website, then you can DDoS it, and they might want to prevent that. In that case, you want not only channel anonymity, you want to protect the location, you also want data anonymity. You want to make sure that when you go to the website, you want to make sure that when you go to the website, you don't sign your name on the form, because if you do, you're revealing your identity in a way that you probably didn't want to. Alternatively, if it's Alice and Bob and they trust each other and they're communicating, maybe they don't care about the data anonymity. Maybe they want to sign their name. Maybe they want strong authentication, and they want observers to not be able to know that it's Alice talking to Bob in this case. So it makes perfect sense to anonymously SSH and have all of your keys set up perfectly, and you know for sure that it's Alice and Bob, but somebody watching Alice doesn't know that she's going to Bob. Somebody watching Bob doesn't know that it's Alice going there, and somebody participating as a node in the infrastructure can't realize that it's Alice talking to Bob. So the goal here is channel anonymity, communication pipe. We want to protect the... Excellent. We want to protect the transport. We don't want to worry about the data that goes through it. And that probably means you should run other applications that take a look at the protocols you're using and scrub the headers, for example, in web browsing and so on. I'll get into that in a bit as well. Does the wireless work right now? Yes. Well, there's a URL. Go there, grab the code, and try it. If you already know basically how onion routing works, I'm going to give everybody else an overview of it right now. And while I'm doing that, we've got it packaged for Debian and Gentoo and BSD and Win32 and so on. Unlike previous systems like Freedom, it doesn't have to run as root. We don't need any weird kernel modules. It's just a user space program like all the other ones. It's published under a free software license. It's not covered by the patent, which previously covered an earlier iteration of onion routing. So this really is free stuff. Okay, so how's all this stuff work? How many people were here for George's talk last hour? Quite a few. Okay, so I'm going to give you a brief overview of mixes, and then talk about proxies, and then talk about how onion routing combines nice features of each. Okay, so the basic idea of a mix, you got a bunch of people sending messages, and you got a bunch of people receiving messages. And the idea is we're trying to prevent somebody observing the system from knowing which envelope corresponds to which message coming out. So the key property here is if you've got four messages going in, then they get mixed around, and nobody knows which ciphertext corresponds to which plain text. The way we actually do this, imagine you've got three servers here, each with their own public key. Alice, the sender, takes her message, encrypts it with the blue key, and then the middle key, and then the yellow key. And a bunch of people do this at the same time with their own messages. So imagine we've got three messages over here, and they're all encrypted with all three keys. And then you send all of them to the first server. He mixes them, decrypts them, sends them to the second, which does it again, and so on. And by the time the messages come out, nobody can know what the correspondence is from one to the next. And the reason why you use more than one here is because if two of the three servers you used are bad, they're not actually mixing, or they're publishing everything that they see, then any single server is still good enough to protect your security. So far, so good? Great. So that's nice if you want to do email. That's nice if you're willing to wait an hour or two between when you send your message and when your message arrives. But what if you want to do SSH, or instant messaging, or IRC, or web browsing? Each layer in what I just described involves public key encryption, which takes quite a while to do if you do it for every packet or something like that. So that's not going to work. Okay, on the other side of the spectrum, we have single hop proxies. We have places like the anonymizer.com. It's basically a computer out there. All of the users show up to the computer, and then they leave it to whatever the website is. And if you are just a website over there, you don't know which guy came over there. And if you're just some guy over there, you don't know where they're going, because there's at least a little bit of encryption between the users and the anonymizer, if you pay them. Okay, so this is all fine and good. It's really simple, which is really nice. It focuses a lot of traffic in one place, which might be nice for anonymity. We'd have to talk more about how to analyze anonymity. On the other hand, it's just one box. If some guy shows up and breaks some kneecaps or provides a subpoena or whatever it takes, then that's it for your anonymity. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to combine the advantages of both of these. We want to take the distributed trust we get from mixes, and then also the idea of using public key encryption just to establish the circuit, and then using quick encryption like SSL once you've done that. And I'll tell you a little bit more about how that works once we get to it. We're not the first people to invent this. Plenty of people have developed designs and even implementations of this. And I'd be happy to chat a little bit more about each of those at the end. But what we have is a working system right now with free code, unpatented, and it appears to work pretty well. Okay, questions so far? Or shall I tell you how Tor works? Okay. So basically, we've got a big network here. Here's Alice. Bob's over on the other end. We've got a bunch of nodes in the middle. And Alice is running some of our code. Alice is running a Tor client. And basically, the Tor client looks just like a SOX proxy from her perspective. So she configures her web browser to point at it, and it all works from there. So she doesn't have to actually change her web browser or run a new web browser to deal with this. And similarly, any other application that can do SOX is doing pretty well in terms of just communicating directly to the local Tor client. The reason why Alice needs one of those is Alice is going to pick her path through the network. Alice is going to manage all the keys that she has, because if she trusts anybody else to manage those keys, then she's probably going to be in bad shape. Okay, so a while ago I was talking to people about I'm building onion routing, and they said, "Oh, really? Which one?" And I said, no, I'm building the onion routing system. This is the original onion routing project. And so that's how the acronym stuck. Or if you prefer recursive acronyms, we've got one of those as well. Okay, so the way we actually build the circuit, Alice picks a first node, she establishes an SSL connection with it, and negotiates an ephemeral session key. From there, she tunnels through the first one to the second one and establishes a new session key with that one. So now she's got two keys going on. This middle guy knows about Alice and knows about the next computer. So then she tunnels to a third one. This guy knows about this one and that one, but doesn't know about what came before it. And then she, so from there, if she has only three hops in her path, she has established her circuit. So far, so good. She's got three keys. Now she has a destination in mind. So she sends a please connect to this address cell. She encrypts it 3 times on her side. It gets decrypted once, another time. And this guy says, oh, I'm supposed to connect to CNN.com for somebody I don't know who. And so he does that. And the connection, it's actually a stream that we've connected, so they just talk back and forth over it using the symmetric encryption. And you can use the single circuit to multiplex many TCP streams. So Alice can be talking to CNN and Fox at the same time. And she can finish talking to one and so on. So far, so good. Okay, so there are a bunch of other engineering details that actually impact security that we have to get right, and we're still in the process of trying to get those right. One of them is directory servers. Right now, the goal of the directory server is to maintain a list of who all the nodes are, what their keys are, what their exit policies are, where they are right now, and so on. We ship the directory server keys with the code, so you can trust that when you get something signed by them, it actually did, in fact, come from a directory server that we intended you to be using. So the goal of the directory servers is we have to... Imagine we didn't have directory servers and you just go anywhere and say, hey, guy out there, can you tell me some Tor servers? If you happen to ask the wrong guy, he will say, certainly, I have 500 great Tor servers. They're all right over there on that network. Why don't you go use those? And that might not be providing the security that Alice is hoping to get. So what we're looking for is some way to make sure that when people sign up new Tor servers, we want to know that they're not all run by the same guy. And so far, having a human in the loop is the best way we've found for that. I'd love to find a better way. And so they're both trust bottlenecks and also performance bottlenecks, because everybody goes to the directory servers to fetch the directory periodically, because it keeps changing. In terms of performance, that's not a problem, because we cache the directory on every single onion router. You can go to anybody, and it's signed by the directory server key, so you know that you got the one you meant to get. In terms of a trust bottleneck, well, we're still working on that. Okay, so it's a pretty small. It's a little under 30,000 lines of C. It's all free software. You can get it and look at it. Quite a few people have looked at it and audited it for interesting security problems, and we've fixed all that we know about, but I'm sure there are some more. Everything runs in user space. You don't have to be root. You can shroot it. You don't have to. It's portable because we don't care about kernel modules and so on. One of the really nice things is that we, while many other projects like this tried to not only do anonymous transport, they also tried to do HTTP scrubbing, and we'll build an IRC proxy, and we'll build an AIM proxy, and so on. We just do SOX. We're a SOX proxy. Most applications can speak SOX, so they can use us directly. And we have exit policies, which is something that a lot of previous projects didn't have very well, which is whenever you volunteer to run a server, you can specify exactly which IPs and ports you will allow to exit from your node and which you won't allow. For example, the default exit policy refuses port 25. So by default, no servers will allow you to spam through them. And if somebody wants to change that and let you spam through them, it's just the same as that guy opening an open relay and publicizing it. So, but the nice thing about the exit policies is that they're actually published by the server, and they get into the directory, and now the clients look at them all. So the client knows which servers are going to succeed and which will fail. So he builds a circuit to an exit node which is going to work for the transaction he's about to do. Okay, we handle many TCP streams in one circuit, which is really nice because you can build the circuit beforehand and you can use it for a minute or two with all the transactions that you're doing at that time. And so the public key operations are amortized over quite a bit of time. And it's nice because against some attacks, we probably have better anonymity compared to opening a whole lot of different circuits. Imagine there are 100 nodes in the network and 10 of them are owned by the bad guy. And you randomly build circuits through a whole bunch of different nodes, and each of those circuits goes and fetches a different picture from CNN.com. If the adversary is wondering which website you're going to, and you build a whole lot of different circuits, randomly picking entry nodes and exit nodes, after a while you're probably going to pick an entry and exit node combination which are both owned by the bad guy. And he's going to realize that it's you talking to CNN. So in that sense, it's probably better to put a lot of different connections over the same circuit to enhance your anonymity. But you don't want to have just one circuit forever, because you'll be in bad shape if he can actually decide, I really want to know who's on the other end of that circuit, so I'm going to go knock on the door of this server, find out who's talking to him, go back that way, and so on. Which typically would take days, but if we had a circuit open that long, it would work. So we rotate the circuits every minute or so, if you've been using them, which seems like an okay compromise. So we've got rate limiting, which all server operators want because they want to be able to control how many bytes they provide to the network. On top of that, we also have congestion control. So if you've got a web server over here and a bunch of Alices going to it, and there's some bottleneck somewhere in the middle of the Tor network, so Alice would send get slash, and the other Alice would do that also, and so on. And all of the web pages would go into the middle of the Tor network, and they'd get plugged up, and the web server would never know to stop sending, so everything would turn bad in the middle of the Tor network. So basically we have an ACK system inside Tor, where the web server only sends a small amount of information, and then Alice says, I got that, send me some more, and so on. So it's really pretty straightforward, but it seems to work for now. Okay, so another property that we have over previous onion routing is protection against malleability or tagging attacks. How many people here know a little bit about crypto, stream ciphers, that sort of thing? Some. Okay, so in a previous onion routing version, we used stream ciphers to do the encryption. You saw the keys that Alice had when she had three keys. Those were stream ciphers. Basically, you've got a big pile of plain text, and you've got a key that generates a big key text, and you XOR them together, and that produces the ciphertext, which is what you sent. So the XOR is great. It's fast. You generate as much key stream as you want. But the problem there is that if the adversary can guess what the plain text is, even when he's in the middle of the circuit, for example, let's say you're FTPing somewhere, and he guesses that you're FTPing somewhere, and he guesses that you just connected somewhere and you're typing DIR enter. So he finds the ciphertext going by on the wire and says, I bet those letters are DIR. So he XORs out DIR, he XORs in RM star and sends it on its way. This may not be what Alice wants to be doing at that FTP server. So we need to provide some way to provide integrity without revealing how many hops there are in the stream. And even when some of the nodes don't know about Alice and haven't shared integrity keys with her before. So I'll leave the details out of that. We solved that as well. Also in a previous onion routing version, the reason it's called onion routing is because of a previous way that we used to build circuits. Long ago, Alice would pick her path, and she would, just as a mix server would do, you saw George talking about reply blocks, she would specify the location, encrypt that with a key, and another one, and so on. And then she'd have this big multi-layered blob, an onion, that has many layers. And she would throw it into the network, it would establish a circuit. So that's all fine and good, except, first of all, you have to start tracking people trying to replay these onions. Because every time I throw the same onion into the network, it establishes the same circuit. And not only that, but the onion specifies the keys that it's going to be sharing with each new server that it's talking about. And those keys are the same are the same for each onion. So this means that if I can grab hold of an onion when Alice starts to use it, I can continue using that in the network and go from server to server and say, here's something encrypted to your private key. Can you please decrypt it for me and tell me the keys that are inside? But since we do the new circuit building approach, we don't have to worry about replay attacks because every key that we share is ephemeral. It's new every time we build a circuit, and as soon as you drop the circuit, there's nothing that each server knows, or that Alice knows, that can reproduce the keys that were involved in that circuit. And that's called perfect forward secrecy. Okay, so we've had a network running for a little over a year. We had 50 servers last week. Now we have more like 70 or 80, because we got slashdotted last week, and there's rather more attention than we'd had before. It's hard to estimate how many users we have, because it's an anonymity network. Especially as I turned off the Apache logs, because so many other projects like this have... many organizations have found the logs interesting, so we no longer have any logs either. So based on looking at how the directory servers work and how many people are asking them for directories, I would guess maybe a couple weeks ago we had 2,000 users, and maybe this week we have 10,000 users or something. So I think there are quite a few users out there running Tor actively right now. And people just use it for web browsing, everything they do, because it, for the most part, it's fast enough to go to Amazon and do everything else that you do. And plenty of people use it to IRC various places. It works out of the box with instant messaging and so on. Depending on the node, it processes maybe a couple of gigabytes a day, or maybe 10 or 20 or 30 gigabytes a day. You can specify the amount of bandwidth you want to provide. And we've got quite a few nodes in the network and quite a few bytes going through it. I've got graphs here. So this is the graph of the number of routers we've got running. You can see that up and for quite a while it was around 40 or 50 servers we had going. And this stretched back to like week 20 or so when the previous slashdotting happened. And this was last week where everything zips up, and I'm hoping to be able to maintain that. And so far, typically, when we get slashdotted, the number of servers goes up and then remains stable until it happens again. So I'm hoping that the stepwise function keeps going up. And total traffic through the Tor network. This solid blue line is the average. This one is the maximum of all the reported things in a given 15-minute period. And then the red line up there is the reported capacity of servers. So you can see that as more use happens of the network, then each server recognizes that it's got more bytes to provide. And we're doing pretty well. We've got a lot more capacity than is being used so far. And if you do the math on some of these things, we're pushing a terabyte a day. So that's quite a bit of data. And we've got some latency tests. A while ago, I did various basic academic things so we could write an academic paper to prove that it wasn't too bad. And when you go to CNN, it takes 2 or 3 seconds to pull down the front page, which is, I mean, it's not the 0.3 seconds that it is without Tor, but 2 or 3 seconds is okay. Okay, before I get to the other feature, any questions so far? Yeah. I almost heard that, but not quite. Can you say it again, or are there other mics? We'll have somebody run a mic back to you. Maybe. Other people can start thinking of other questions as we do this. Great.
Are you going to provide the DNS blacklist service for the for your exit nodes? I mean, blacklist service, so anyone could use that for it, for their policy enforcement.
I still fail to hear the question.
DNS blacklist is the way to distribute data about some nodes you would not allow to enter your service. So
That's a tough question with a lot of different answers. So the question, as I heard it, was sometimes there are a bunch of users that you might not want using your system, or sometimes there are a bunch of exit destinations that you might not want to let people get to. Is that?
Yeah, right. So I wonder if there will be available a service that you just can plug into and say that I don't want to allow Tor clients instead of decoding such services ourselves. So.
I'm still not quite sure what that question is, so you should ask it to me afterwards, and we'll continue from there. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, so we've got a separate feature on top of Tor. So far I've told you how to provide forward anonymity. Let's imagine Alice is wanting to browse the web and she wants to keep the web server from knowing who she is. Or she's instant messaging somebody and she wants to keep the guy she's sending it to from knowing who she is. On the other hand, let's imagine we want to run a web server without... let's imagine we want to run a web server without letting other people know where we are providing the service from. We don't want to publish the IP of this web server. We want to run an instant messaging server. We want to run an SSH server without revealing to people where it lives, what continent it's on, what IP it has. We want it to be accessible from anywhere. We want to be able to provide service to anybody regardless of where on the internet they are. We want it to resist censorship. We don't want it to be easy to shut it off. We want to not require too much redundancy, but we still want to provide some resistance against DOS. It would be really nice if even when a full-blown DOS attack is happening on this site, it can still be able to provide some service to people that it likes more. And it would be really nice if it's resistant to physical attack. For example, when they send the bombers or the guys to break kneecaps, they don't know where to send them. Okay, so imagine we've got some server Bob. He wants to run an Apache service, for example. So he picks a bunch of introduction points, servers on the Tor network, and he onion routes out to them. He builds a circuit, just as we saw before, and he establishes an introduction point at each one of these. He has generated a public-private key pair for his service, and he wants to allow people to get to that. So step two is he builds what's called a service descriptor, which describes the public key, which ports are available, maybe some description of it, what the introduction points are right now. He signs that with the key, and he publishes it somehow anonymously. Right now, the directory servers handle a big pile of these, and Bob can add to it, and Alice can retrieve from it. But it could be any sort of distributed, robust system. So step two, Prime Alice fetches it. And so I've left out a step here. Somehow, out of band, Bob gets some short string, the hash of the public key, to Alice. And you could imagine, for example, he publishes that on a wiki. He puts it on a web page somewhere. Alice clicks on it. It's the hash of a public key. We've added a new top-level domain called .onion. So you find a host name somewhere on a website called blah, 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 .onion, and she clicks on it. Her Mozilla passes that to her Tor client, which looks at it and says, oh, that's a .onion address. And it starts to do all of this automatically. So all of this is implemented, and you can use it right now. Okay, so step three, it's a little bit more complicated than at first thought you would want it to be. So step three ought to be, Alice has learned an introduction point, so she goes to an introduction point and talks to Bob. That's what step three ought to be. But the problem is, nobody wants to run one of those introduction points. Nobody wants to be the place associated with an arbitrary service that somebody is trying to hide. So we add another layer of indirection as true computer scientists. Alice picks a rendezvous point, is some other Tor server that's unrelated to any of this, and she builds a circuit there and says, you're my rendezvous point. If somebody shows up and has this 20-byte cookie, he's the guy I want to talk to. Then she connects to one of the introduction points and says, hi, I want to talk to you. This is the rendezvous point I picked. Here's the cookie you should use to get to it. Here's the G to the X. Here's the first half of my establishing a session key with you. If you want to talk to me, I'm over there. And at that point, Bob can say, I'm sorry, I'm busy. Screw off. At which point, Alice never gets the connection. Or Bob can say, great, I'd be happy to talk to Alice. So he builds his own circuit out. Because he's building the circuit, he gets his anonymity from that to the rendezvous point. And then he says to the rendezvous point, I want to talk to whoever has this cookie established. And by the way, can you tell them G to the Y? Can you tell them the other half of this session key establishment? And then the rendezvous point connects the two. And Alice learns G to the Y. She already knew X. And Bob learns G to the X. He already knows Y. So Alice and Bob are now talking to each other in an encrypted way over a point that doesn't know Alice, doesn't know Bob, and can't read what they're saying. So the introduction points never produced any bytes to Alice. So yes, they're associated with the service, but all they did was receive requests from anonymous people and tell Bob, hey, somebody wanted to tell you these bytes. So the people who are associated with the service haven't done anything. And the rendezvous points could be running in a place that has a whole lot of bandwidth, and they don't have any idea what they're participating with. Okay, so far so good. Questions?
Please wait.
Yeah. How do I prevent man in the middle attacks in what? Okay. So the question is, how do I prevent man in the middle attacks in this step? Alice is going to connect to the introduction point, and she's going to say, here's the rendezvous point I picked, here's the rendezvous cookie, here's the G to the X, and she encrypts it to the private key of the service. And because she encrypts it to the private key of the service, to the public key of the service, then only Bob could know the G to the X that she sent to it. So when Bob, in fact, sends a G to the Y back, then Alice is going to end up with a session key, and Bob is going to end up with a session key. And if it's really Bob, it'll be the same session key. And if it's not really Bob, it won't be the same session key. So it won't work when they start communicating. Did that answer that? Great. There was another question. Should you run a mic to them, maybe? Maybe somebody should queue up a big list and I'll keep going in the talk. There we go.
Can you run a Tor server on a dynamic IP address?
Can you run a Tor server on a dynamic IP address? Yes. The code looks at your IP every 15 minutes, and if it's changed, then it publishes the new one. And you can also specify an address, dynamicdns.org address, so that gets resolved into whatever your IP ought to be. Not only that, but that reminds me of another interesting thing. This Bob over here, he can run deep inside some corporate firewall. Notice that nobody's ever connected to Bob. He has no IP address. There's no way to get to him. He always connects out whenever he wants to talk anywhere. So if you're able to get bytes out, you're able to run a hidden service. When I left here to come to Germany and give a talk, I don't have any way to get bytes into my internal firewall, but I'm running a hidden service pointing to my SSH daemon. So there's no way for me to connect inside my firewall except through the hidden service, which, of course, goes to the SSH daemon and then requires full authentication, and yet it's anonymous with respect to observers. So this is, I gave this talk at Black Hat a little while ago, and somebody stood up and said, "You're violating my security policy." And I said, "I'm not violating your security policy. Your employees might be, but..." So this is something that the security folks are a little bit uncomfortable about, but it's where the world is going, so. Okay, so there are a bunch of different anonymity systems. How do we try to figure out which one is better than another one? There are a lot of different ways of doing this. George touched on a couple of them. I'm going to give you one more. Imagine there are N servers out there, and the adversary owns C of these N servers, and he can pick which ones. In the Tor design, which is a free route design, Alice can pick any path she wants to. The chance that the adversary wins is based on being able to see the traffic at the beginning of the connection and the traffic at the end. So if C over N of the nodes are compromised, then there's a C over N chance she picks a bad entry node, and a C over N chance she picks a bad exit node. If she picks both of them bad, C squared over N squared, then she loses. The reason for this is because this is a low latency system where stuff has to get from Alice to Bob reasonably quickly. We can't delay it and pad it and batch it and so on. So there are plenty of statistical attacks that work really well if you're able to see the traffic on Alice's side and the traffic on Bob's side. You can become convinced that they're the people talking to each other. So the goal of the Tor network is to make the network so diverse and make sure everything is dispersed enough that realistic adversaries won't be able to be watching all of the inputs and all of the outputs to the network. Okay, so based on that, the Tor network gives you C squared over N squared security for this attack. And to put some actual numbers on that, we've got 1% of the transactions are nailed if 10 of the 100 nodes are bad. And there are some other systems that have been trying to provide anonymity in very similar situations, like Peekabooty in 6.4. Typically, the characteristic there is that Alice goes to some node and says, hey, can you build me a circuit? And if she picks an honest node, then the honest node randomly chooses another node and says, hey, can you build me a circuit? But if she picks a bad node, then the guy says, oh, certainly. I'd be happy to build a very secure circuit for you. I'll use this guy and this guy and this guy. It's all set. Feel free to talk. And Alice may not be getting what she's hoping to get again. So in that sort of situation, if you choose a bad entry node, then you lose right off. And so in the numbers we're talking about, 10 of 100, 10% chance. There's also a system called JAP that's deployed in Germany, and they have a node now in New York University and a couple other places. It has a different topology approach than Tor. The JAP network uses cascades, fixed routes through the network. So, for example, if you've got a bunch of different users, they all go to the same entry node. They all go to node number 2 and then node number 3, and then they all exit to various web servers or whatever they're exiting to. So this is great in that you've got the entry node in a different place than the exit node. But because of these statistical attacks that work really well looking at traffic going into the entry node and comparing it to traffic exiting from the exit node, if the adversary is able to see the beginning and the end, then he beats every single user who's using that cascade. So if you've got nodes in the middle of the cascade, they're not helping you at all. They're just slowing you down. They're not impacting security at all. It's all about the entry node and the exit node. And up until a couple of years ago, many, if not all, of the JAP cascades were running in the same room, I believe, in some coloc somewhere. So that was a little bit tricky for their security as well. So assuming you use cascades of length 4, basically you're getting not quite the same security as Tor, because your middle nodes, there's no point in the adversary compromising them or doing a subpoena to look at them or going to beat up the operator or whatever attack he's going to do. He can just totally ignore the nodes in the middle and just focus on the end nodes. And for excitement, I've added another comparison of the anonymizer, which is if the adversary can compromise anything, then everybody loses. Which sounds pretty bad, but on the other hand, it's pretty good, because if the adversary can't compromise anything, then everybody wins. So just depends how you look at it. And it depends how much you want to trust the one particular jurisdiction and one particular guy who runs the company and each of the janitors of the coloc in which the servers are run and so on. Okay, so there are a bunch of trade-offs here that I haven't gotten into, and I'd be happy to talk about afterwards, or there's a little bit more talking about them in the design documents. So we've got low latency versus high latency. George talked about Mixminion. I've talked about Tor. Might be nice to at least think about some research designs that are in the middle that can provide the ability to get your website in a minute or two and have some protection against the end-to-end statistical attacks I talked about. Freedom provided packet level capture, where it could handle UDP, it could handle ICMP. Basically, it put a kernel module in, and it grabbed all the IP packets, encoded them, shoved them to the other end of the circuit, and then put them out onto the network again. Which is really nice because you can ping over Freedom and you can do DNS over Freedom, and I guess you could play Quake over Freedom if it worked. On the other hand, Freedom isn't around anymore because it's not free, and they closed it down when they weren't making enough money. So that's one advantage that Tor has. It's free. But it would be really nice if we could do the packet level stuff in a reasonable fashion without sacrificing the fact that we're only in user space and that we're very portable. You have a question?
Speaking of DNS, how do you solve that problem of clients doing the DNS requests?
So that's a really good question. So the problem is that if Alice is using her Mozilla and pointing it directly to her SOX proxy, then she types in www.google.com. Her machine broadcasts, what's the IP of google.com? It gets an answer. And then she anonymously goes somewhere. Which may not, again, be what she had in mind. So the way this works is there are a bunch of different SOX protocols. There's 4, 4A, and 5. Some of them you hand the IP of where you're trying to go. Some of them you hand the host name of where you're trying to go. And Alice should use the protocol type where she hands google.com to the Tor client, which sends it to the other end of the circuit, and that other end resolves it and connects. Now, in practice, Mozilla doesn't support SOX 4A. It doesn't support the variant that I just talked about. But there are web proxies like Privoxy that do support that. So you point your Mozilla at Privoxy, which is pointed at the Tor client, and then you go. And this is also really nice because you need Privoxy to filter out the headers, to avoid going to junk double click every time you go anywhere and having them figure out, I don't know who this guy is, but he's interested in cars, these drugs, and these websites. They're still going to build profiles, and profiles are, they have a nasty habit of anytime anybody actually gets a real name and a little bit of data, then they can realize that this thing they do know is exactly the same as this huge profile they've been building on this pseudonym. So you really want to be using Privoxy anyway, and Privoxy does support the type of SOX that is good for this. Okay, another question we've got, what sort of user interface do we want on this? Right now we have no user interface. There's a daemon, it runs in the background, you use it as a SOX proxy. The user interface is your web browser, or your instant messenger, or your IRC client. This is really nice, but if something goes wrong inside Tor, we want to be able to push that back out to the user in a way that lets him understand what's going on. So we're trying to maybe do something better about that. So another issue that we've got is BGP level paths, routing paths. Imagine you've got a whole bunch of nodes all around the world, and you've got a bunch of Alices in different places. If it happens that there are a couple of organizations on the internet, like telephone companies, that are able to watch several backbone pieces of the internet, now while you think Alice is bouncing around and then going to her destination, in fact, she's going to the internet, and then the internet, and then the internet, and then the internet, and then going to her destination. And if there's a guy watching everything, running the telephone lines that she's using, running the internet, then in fact, she's not getting the diversity of transaction that she was hoping for. We've done some research, and in practice, there are quite a few large telcos that are able to observe most of the internet, at least as far as Tor clients and servers are concerned. So we need to start thinking about when Alice is going to build a circuit, she needs to pick a first node, an entry node, that's quite close to her on the network. So she gets into the Tor network as soon as possible, and then maybe she mixes around a bit more with other people that are nearby her quickly. That, we need a lot more research for that. That one's going to be a tricky one to solve. And incentives to run servers. So far, nice people run servers. That's our answer. And it's a better answer than any other answer people have provided. In the Freedom case, they said, oh, we'll pay them. Freedom's not running anymore. JAP, every couple of years, needs to find more funding to pay the people running the servers. In a couple more years, they may not have the funding for it. There may be no more JAP. So the only sustainable model we've found so far is nice people run the servers. And You saw the graph. Hopefully it'll keep going up. And incentives to run exit nodes. One of the nice things here is that as of a month or so ago, we're now being funded by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org, and they're a big group of lawyers who are very interested in the legal issues of exit nodes, and they're really interested in making sure that Tor is the case study that people are looking at, rather than a bunch of people jumping up and down saying, file sharing is for everyone, you can't stop me. Because we're talking about ordinary, honest people who want to do web browsing. That's our model user. So they'd rather have that be the question than the other questions that people are asking. And there are a bunch of other issues. It'd be nice to decentralize things some more. And there's a bunch of future work that we should do. The website has a lot of details about this sort of thing, but I'll give you a couple examples here. It would be really nice. Right now we have a clique topology where all the nodes are assumed to be able to connect to all the other nodes. So you basically get your big router list, and then you build your list. You build your circuit out of any of the nodes you want. That's probably not going to scale to thousands of nodes, because each node doesn't want to have to connect to all of these. It might be nice if each node specifies, I'll connect to the following 10, and another node will connect to a different 10, and you can build yourself a graph and create a circuit out of that. And if you build a small world graph, then you can be sure to get from anywhere to anywhere in a reasonably short number of hops. And heterogeneous bandwidth is a big mess. Up until recently, we only wanted people on T1s or better because we wanted to provide good throughput and good reliability to users. Now I'm pretty sure we can handle people on cable modems and DSL and so on because we've got more load balancing. The servers passively estimate the capacity they've got based on looking at how many bytes they've managed to push so far. And they publish that in the directory, and clients look at that and choose which servers they're going to use proportional to the capacity that they've published. So that seems to be working pretty well. We've got a lot of DSL and cable modem nodes right now. We have a Win32 package. It'd be nice if somebody here knows more about Win32 installers, if we could put Provoxy inside of it. That would be really handy, because then people would just click, click, and they'd have everything installed. So another interesting thing would be putting up exit proxies so that when you run an exit server, you also run a SQID right next to it. Every request that's going to go to port 80 goes into your SQID, and most of them never have to leave your SQID if everybody's reading CNN or whatever porn site they're reading that day or whatever. If most of the users are going to the same place, then you're going to get a lot better anonymity if the transactions never have to leave the exit node. Because that end-to-end attack I was talking about involves looking at the traffic from Alice and the traffic to Bob. And if there is no traffic to Bob, then Alice is doing a lot better. And there's a lot more research in theory that we need to do. Could we perhaps slow things down to get a lot better security? Or when we slow things down, do we get just a little bit of security? And maybe we should assume that there are fewer bad nodes and see if we can get a better design out of that. Okay, and the last slide. We've got free code. It comes with documentation. It comes with a byte-level specification, which meant that the JAP folks were able to independently implement their own Tor client, and they're going to be announcing that whenever they get around to announcing that. We've got a design paper, system spec, code. There's the URL. Questions? If you're the second person with a question, find somebody with a mic.
Most IRC networks routinely block open proxies to prevent spam. Mm-hmm. Are you going to provide some sort of easy library for system administrators to allow them to block the whole Tor network?
No. I think that IRC systems and most other systems should not be authenticating by IP address, because that makes no sense. There are entire groups of thousands of users on single IPs. For example, AOL, for example, Japan. You really don't want that an IP is a person. You want to start thinking that an account on your whatever is a person, and the account is what you should be blocking. But if people want to do stuff based on IP, then Feel free, we can't stop you. Other questions?
When a person looks at Amazon about books and he will now buy a book, will he compromise himself?
Good question. Tor is one building block, and you need many more building blocks. At least a couple years ago, there was a company you could go to that would let you ship something to a pseudonym. Basically, only FedEx and you know where it's going to go to. But Amazon just gives this big encrypted blob to FedEx, and then they deliver it. So Tor will not stop the fact that the postman knows where you live. Nor will it stop the fact that you give your credit card and name and address to Amazon if you want to do that.
No, I mean, when I tell my name at Amazon, have they a chance to make use of the...
Anders wird darauf hingewiesen, dass der Betrieb von 802.11g und 802.11b Access Points sowohl im Rechtscenter als auch im Rest des Gebäudes extrem unerwünscht ist. Es wird darauf hingewiesen, dass der Betrieb von Access Points im Rechtscenter und anderen Teilen des Gebäudes extrem unerwünscht ist. Vielen Dank.
When I reach Amazon with a Tor client, is there a chance that the keys are used to come to Amazon, that they can be used to detect me from other people who know my address or something else? Is there something insecure?
We should talk about that one afterwards, because I'm not quite sure what the question is. I think we're mostly done here, and I would be happy to stand outside and answer any further questions you guys have. Thank you.